Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Tracy.
How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. Are you enjoying the view out the window?
Yes,
there?
Lovely. It's not as snowy as last week.
Yeah.
But I think it's coming.
But it's kind of interesting. This is our second week in the new studio.
And yes.
So new surroundings, kind of, you know, like a change is as good as a rest.
Yeah, it's exciting. Mm-hmm. Get up in the morning. Let's go to the new studio. Hooray.
Yay.
Maybe you don't have to walk up all those stairs.
I know.
Sorry, Dak.
Yeah.
I do love you. It's just you have lots of stairs.
Yes. And there's a certain school feel about it, and this feels different. So,
absolutely.
Sometimes
it feels different. And it's a busy spot. My goodness. There's hardly a parking to be found.
I know. I was like, what's going on this early on the. Well, anyway.
Yeah, it's really becoming a community hub. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Anyway, it's very
thank
exciting.
Thank you to our new landlords.
Yeah. Yes. And innovation in space use is kind of the theme of the day, right?
Yes.
So let's enjoy it.
Fantastic. It's a collection. of community gatherings happening here.
Thank you for allowing me to say the word segue again. I love it so much. I see it spelt when I say it.
Do segue. You segue?
Yes.
Yes.
Because it's not the motorized car
thing. No, that goes over the cliff. No, it's not that. It's the thing that connects two seemingly unrelated topics.
But we did it. You did it.
There you go.
Today.
Oh, I can connect anything that's unrelated. I'm really good at that. Yeah. Shiny thing.
Thanks, engineer. Extra chuckles. Today we're talking about collections.
Yes.
The art of collections of art.
Of art.
Yes. That's our innovative title.
Yeah. And it's informed by the next show, which opens.
Which opens on January 18th.
January 18th.
That's Friday night, January 18th.
This Friday. If you're listening live.
Yeah, and it goes until February 23rd. So you
wonderful.
Got 5 weeks to see this show. It's called In Dialogue with the Collection.
Because people may not know this, but our public gallery has a
community art collection.
And it's pretty significant.
170 works.
Holy moly, Batman.
I know. And a lot of that is due to a recent donation by the very prolific art supporter, Dolores Mori.
Isn't that right? Well, kudos to Dolores.
Yep, 36
Dolores
works.
Strikes again.
She really does. 36 works she donated to the collection over the past year, 14 months or so. We've been cataloging it and making it part of this incredibly valuable collection, right? Like, this is an asset for our community.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much par for the course, right? Mm-hmm. Private people, royalty, kings, queens, leaders have these private collections that then get put on display publicly and eventually become public.
Right.
Yes.
And what we're talking about here, like I'll talk more about the specifics of the exhibition coming up in a moment, but what I want to talk about today is that there's some controversy about collections. There's quite a few little problems with collections, and one of them is that on average only 5% of museum and art galleries collections are on display at any given time.
Only 5?
5%.
Oh man, we're hiding so much stuff.
We are hiding so much stuff, and in basements and vaults and, you know, storage rooms.
God, I'm
all
just
over the place.
Visions of my sea can in my yard full of Tupperware bins. Full of stuff. I'm like, did I have that? Is there one of those? Yeah.
But you know,
well, curators must be feel the same way. Like, don't we have a Van Gogh in the basement somewhere?
Yeah. Well, I know, like, sometimes I have to remind myself I have 2 Chris Crayons in the collection. Like, this isn't, you know, like,
holy
we have
Nelly,
and also sometimes things like if you haven't looked at your collection, if you haven't dug it out, unwrapped it, looked at stuff, you know, in a while, you need to refamiliarize yourself with a collection because you do. So they're in there, they're in your database, but you do forget what you have.
Yeah, and your mental database and your physical database.
Yeah.
And in fact, few galleries, even the big ones, have curators who are responsible solely for cataloging, maintaining, archiving, right? Is that right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So actually, I have stats on that because CMA, the Canadian Museum Association, did a study on collections.
Well, do share.
Okay, well, it happens that even though it seems like every museum and art gallery that has a collection should have people dedicated to the preservation and display of that collection.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you have a 100% of your lawn, but you only take care of 5% of it.
Yeah.
You know?
I know, but guess what?
What?
Only half of the museums and art galleries in Canada have staff dedicated to the preservation of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and most of the CMA members are larger than us. Like I'd say,
I would say so. Yeah. Yes,
yeah. We are at the bottom end of the size of galleries and museums.
Yeah, because they're rated, right? A galleries, B yeah. Gal- yes. Yeah.
But we are the little among the littlest.
The littlest.
Yeah. Yes, and so if and it's understandable that we don't have staff dedicated to our collection.
Yeah.
But to imagine that, 50% of all galleries and mm-hmm. museums in Canada do not have staff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cost issue.
Yes.
Because it costs money
for sure.
to have staff. And the collections don't generate income. So
no, but they do have value, which is not on... That's just the other thing. It's like human resources. It's not on the financial statement.
Yep. And in fact, in the financial statements, when you take your stuff to the accountant every year, your collection goes down in value.
No, how could it?
I don't know, but yeah. it just does. And we actually brought that up a few years back saying, why is it that we always have to take this little weird
depreciation
loss every year? This depreciation and our piano too. Why is our piano depreciating?
It's
why is
appreciating?
Yeah. So yeah. to a point where our piano is worth about $26 right oh. now, which is crazy because it's this gorgeous mm-hmm. parlor lounge. Or
grand piano.
Yeah, so that's a problem that I think accountants and art, you know, the museums have to figure out themselves. But that is just a major issue that this value isn't monetized mm-hmm. and doesn't generate revenue for an organization. So that's one of the things that makes it a controversial.
Well, if topic. If it's an asset and it's appreciating, or an investment that's appreciating, you could. Capitalize on mm-hmm. you know, borrow money to do more things.
Well, that's true, and that's what Detroit did during the big auto crisis,
yes.
the financial crisis mm-hmm. of 2008.
Mm-hmm. They saved their butts.
It did.
Mm-hmm.
It was the reason that they could.
Detroit was going to go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's alive again. And
yeah.
So
the value of their art collection allowed them to borrow money against mm-hmm. the work.
Yes.
And yeah
Because so, if we get in trouble, we'll just pawn that Da Vinci and we're all good, right? I mean, well, it's, why not?
And if you're...
I mean, art is money you hang on your wall if you want to be like really pedantic and...
Yeah.
You know.
And some people do only buy art for investment.
Yes, of course.
But it's an issue, right? Like it's a philosophical position that you put yourself in. Either you see art as an investment or you see art as something that you just need to have in your
yeah,
life.
Yeah, and if it's something you happen to love that also has value, even better.
That's
right.
Double happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the other thing though, is that there's been a movement over the past few decades to prevent museums and art galleries from selling their work
mm-hmm.
because...
Which is also a common practice.
It is, except that now there's what is it?
Or has been.
It has been. Yeah. And it's been controversial because communities feel like that's their art collection, right? Like it's not just the...
Yeah,
the,
you can't sell my stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's true, right? Yeah. Like I kind of feel like this art collection that the Arts Council holds actually belongs to the Shoe Swap.
Yes.
It does not belong to me personally
yes.
or you as a member or, right? Like
yeah.
it is the entire community. So we cannot do with it as the Arts Council pleases. It has to be community decisions.
Mm-hmm.
However, and you know, we have a small community, but bigger cities, you can imagine. And that it's just not fair to say, oh, we've decided we're going to have this program and we need to fund it,
yes.
so we're going to sell this Picasso.
Well, sell Voice of Fire.
Oh,
make a bucket load of money.
Oh, no kidding. Hey, boy, was that a good investment.
Yes.
Speaking of good investments.
Sorry, I can't talk about our collections and not throw Voice of Fire in there. But
it's a great example
yes.
of people freaking out about money spent, but now not that much time later. It's worth about 30 times
mm-hmm.
what we paid
yeah.
for it.
I don't so know if talk you've looked at your RSP statement, but it's not the case. Should have bought Voice of Fire.
Yeah.
Note to self.
So but, just so you know, the Association of Art Museum Directors, because of policy all over the world that has happened that has effectively banned sales of art. The Association of Art Museum Directors has created a set of circumstances by which you would be able to sell art from collections.
Okay.
However, the money raised has to be used to purchase more art.
Right.
So that's the blah.
Yes.
Because a lot
not
of organizations...
Not to build a wing or host like a super cool show or...
No, not for a contemporary exhibition
right.
or anything like that.
Right.
And in fact, they've blacklisted museums who have sold
Ouch.
Art trying to escape.
But have we not all sold art? Like, I know at one point we did we not thin out our own community collection?
We did thin it out.
Yeah.
And it's because we had an express purpose of starting the endowment fund with the community foundation. And we couldn't start it with it with less than $10,000.
Well, there you go.
And so, yeah, that's what we did.
And
we,
now
we
the endowment fund is at?
Well, the combined between the two, between the SAGA Endowment Fund, which was originally started with the Mary Coles Mitchell donation,
yes,
and the Arts Council's Endowment Fund, the two together come to about $360,000.
Wow!
Mm-hmm. I know.
So far, even it even supersedes the value of the building.
Oh yeah!
So it's the greatest asset. It started with one.
Yep.
Donation and a sales of, I mean, that's remarkable.
Yeah. And
so you don't get that money. You just get the interest off the money.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. That's, it's technically gifted to the foundation and then they grant us the interest every year.
It lives in perpetuity.
But what, one of the things that a lot of people don't know that we did is for some of the work, because the only works that were taken out of the collection that were made available for sale is works that were either duplicated, like we had prints, and then like serigraphs or something like that, or works that we also had multiples from a specific artist, and there were certain ones that were deemed to be like, well, this is representative of this time and this thing and this historical thing, and so these two are not as, you know, like important to our story.
Right.
So it wasn't just like willy-nilly, everybody come make us an offer, right?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like that.
It wasn't like garage.
Yeah. And in addition to that, some of the works, we made an agreement with the purchaser that upon their leaving the planet, they would donate that back to the collection.
Oh, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So it's kind of...
So you're just loaning it.
It's like, yeah, we basically just rented it.
Yeah.
Rented it out to people. Yeah. So it's not, it wasn't as like a clearinghouse as it sounds when
no.
said we
sold No. And I'm only, I mean, it, you know, interest of transparency.
Yeah. And it was a very, like, it was something that was talked about a lot at the time. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it with former board members, other community members, right? Like, just all kind of, let's make sure that everybody's comfortable with this, because if we're not, we don't want to go down this road.
Very, very wise.
Yeah.
And very healthy, thoughtful, structured decision. Right?
Yeah.
And look where it's got you. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So good things. So,
but maybe not anymore.
Well, it wouldn't, I don't know if it'd be possible anymore. Like, this has become a bigger issue now.
Right.
Bigger philosophically among the industry.
I met the curator of the Beaverbrook one summer, and, you know, he shared quite openly that they will sell works, or if families want to donate their private collections, they'll take the pieces they like and sell the rest.
Yeah, well,
they say that up front, like, we might not want everything. And, of course, people have an emotional attachment to their collection, and why would you sell my Mary Pratt instead of my this or my that, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's how it works.
Yeah.
So if you want to make a contribution, you contribute, and we decide based on the value, right?
Well, and we've done similar with the Art in the Attic. So if people are making a donation of multiple things, we say, would you be okay with some of this work being offered in Art in the Attic as our annual fundraiser?
Yes.
And most of them have said absolutely, because it's been lots of small pieces or something.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, whatever. I just want it to be seen go out there in the world.
For sure.
So we actually had a great Cyril Thompson donation recently, and there were seven works. We kept five in the collection and put two in Art in the Attic.
Well done.
Were purchased by family members. So it's good. Worked
there
out good.
Go.
But I guess I want to say that art collections are really important, and it might seem like a static, boring, dusty basement kind of topic, but it's not.
No.
And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have this particular show that's coming up at the gallery, is because it creates, in a way, it creates a living collection.
Yes. A conversation with the collection.
Yeah. We're reactivating, reigniting the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important, and I came back, and this is something I do want to credit Diana Pratt Johnson with, because when I came back from the CMA conference in early 2017, I was so fired up about bringing the works from the collection into the contemporary exhibitions.
Yes.
I just thought, we have to have this, like, every exhibition has to have dialogue with works from the collection.
Yes.
So we did that with the Blue Trail. I brought in all of these works that were about water to kind of have as a little mini gallery in the lounge at the same time as we had our contemporary exhibition.
And if you like this, you might also like these.
Yeah. But it was really about, like, wow, look at how we used to look at water compared to how we're looking at water now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so really it was a conversation with Diana that I had, and we realized this is that we could do this on an individual basis, how, just like Vancouver Art Gallery did. Because then I went, or before that even, I went and saw the Douglas Copeland in Dialogue with Emily Carr. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what? This is awesome. Like, who thought of this? This is a great idea, because you really look at the Emily Carr work differently after Douglas Copeland has had his way with all these elements and brought elements from her work into his and her story into his and created all these wonderful, crazy contemporary things. And then I discovered that Douglas Copeland was not the only one to do that. No. Sunny Asu did that. Mm-hmm. And like, there's all kinds of different responses to her work that challenge it, right? Like the kind of, especially because she did appropriate First Nations imagery.
Yes.
So there's like Sunny Asu is a First Nations artist, and being able to see the response to that was very exciting.
Yes.
And so it's not just about like, oh, glorifying some historic artist. It's about reigniting a conversation.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's what we're doing.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah.
It is exciting. Yeah. And we've got 12 different artists. Well, yes. Actually, one is a collaborative of two artists. Plus, we have a whole arts group, the Blind Bay Painters, of 20 artists who are responding to a work by Margaret Lund. And of course, you know who Margaret
yes.
Lund is.
Because former mayor of Seminar.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. And a very horsey painter.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the name or the award at the Fall Fair that is named for her is Best Animal Painting.
Oh, that's right. That's yeah, right.
Very well known for her horse paintings. And being a rider too. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the point is that bringing some of these stories back to life is one aspect. But the fact is that most of these, I think all of the contemporary artists who decided to be part of this exhibition have some incredible connection to the person.
Oh, wow.
Like the stories are so super cool.
Oh, that's
the funnest part of the whole show.
No
is,
kidding.
Is reading the stories of how these people are connected.
So will we see that contemporary piece and the collection piece together?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
They're basically side by side.
Yes.
And in some cases, just really close to each other. So it's not as much about a comparison. It's about like being able to go back and forth and say, oh yeah, I can see where she was inspired by this idea. And oh, I see why she took that technique and just really tried something crazy and different. Or this reference to this place in the shoe swap was so specific. This is another place in the shoe swap, right? Like there's all kinds of different ways it's connected. But the written, this is one of those shows where the written catalog is just as important as being able to see the works.
Oh, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's really cool. You're going to love it, especially the Byrne Smith, Marg Robertson connection.
Oh, okay. I'm excited. Yes. Friday night.
Friday night, 7:00.
Yay.
Okay. So I can talk some more about some of the individual artists later, but in addition to the challenge of the cost of conservation in the museums, I want to talk about the other great challenge for collections is storage.
Yeah.
Surprise.
I know. Like, where do we put all this stuff?
And it's happening on an individual basis too. Where do we put all our stuff?
People, do we show it somewhere else? Do we, what do we do?
Well, people are buying storage space like crazy mm-hmm. in storage lockers.
Oh, storage is huge business.
Yeah.
There's no question.
And we're paying for it. That's the crazy thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you think about it, we're paying real estate to store
yeah,
stuff that we're not
space.
Looking at.
Yeah.
It's a problem, which is why I think we mentioned Marie Kondo last week.
Yes, yes, yes.
The whole tidying up mm-hmm. thing, and decluttering has been a thing for quite a while. But the point is storage is not going away as a problem. And then
but
we have,
the collection at the gallery is properly stored and archived.
It's not properly stored and archived. No, we don't have a climate control storage room in the gallery.
And it's marginally archived? I mean,
it's archived in the sense that it's...
We have a list?
Yes. It's well documented. That's one thing that I just kind of do off the side of my desk mm-hmm. all the time. But it's archived and things are wrapped and packaged and protected as best we can. But it's certainly not being kept in the best conditions.
No.
It would be wonderful if we could do something about that in the future.
Right.
But that's not on the immediate horizon.
No.
So, but the storage issue is definitely an issue worldwide. And the fact is, we keep making art.
Mm-hmm.
And then we keep buying art.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep needing to put it somewhere.
We keep collecting it.
Yeah.
It needs to go somewhere.
So where's it going? Right? And then there's all this contemporary work that is large, big installations, big
structures. Room size installations.
Yeah. And they're being purchased. Those artists are being purchased by national galleries all over the world. Where are they putting
it? In the basement.
It's like unsustainable. There's to run out of room.
Sustainability. Actually, in fact, on the way in, I was listening to the Mothership and an artist from a German Namibian descent has put giant speakers.
I just heard that too. Yes.
In the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
In Namibia. Namibia, yes.
Yeah.
1,000 kilometers from anywhere on either side, and they're meant to last forever. And they're blaring the song Africa
by Toto.
Right?
Isn't that crazy?
I guess it doesn't have to worry about storage, but.
No.
Yeah.
Meant to last forever. I thought forever. That was an interesting thing that they're never going to. How is that?
How do they power?
Well, there must be solar power.
Must be solar power. I mean, it's widely available in the desert, but.
Yeah. But still.
Like we talked about last week, we don't have a space problem. We have a use of space problem.
Yeah. Storage is one of the things identified by small and large organizations as an issue going forward. So we have to kind of think about this. All right. Are we going to keep spending capital on building storage, or are we going to get smarter about what we're storing? Mm-hmm. With art, it's a problem, right? We can't just say, oh, we'll just recycle it, right? Like, it's art. It's our history.
It's sacred in a way. You can't just recycle it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know, like, without criticizing the Paint and Sips Night, which are so great social gatherings, I'm a little reluctant to go because I think, well, what am I going to do with that canvas?
Yeah.
And then someone said, well, just paint over it. Well, but why?
Yeah, you're just creating.
So I'm sort of challenged by that. Mm-hmm. So it has to be the right thing, something that I would. You know,
yeah.
Of course, I don't hang my own art in my own house because I'm not an artist. But
I wish it was not made with plastic, right? Like acrylic is just plastic, liquid plastic.
Liquid plastic. Yeah. So watercolor.
Yeah.
Which is more challenging.
A watercolor paint night would be a much more environmentally friendly situation.
Yes.
Yeah. But whatever. Anyway, that's a whole different thing. But you're right. If we're jumping out there and massively creating these things just for the socialization. It's not the best kind of adding to the world of art.
Yeah, conversation about utility and scarcity and
But still, we're left with all of this, you know, all of the historic art.
Yeah,
that's
and it's
important.
Not like you can put it on the buy and sell and hope someone picks it up for right. It's very difficult to sell art.
Yes,
it's an art to be able to sell art.
Yeah, and people really should be qualified in appraising.
Well, I would hope so.
Like, people come into the gallery all the time, or else they phone us or they email us to say, I've got a so-and-so, how much is it worth? There are people that take four-year degrees to be able to answer that question.
Yes, yes.
I'm not one of them.
No, exactly.
So my best suggestion to that is to go online and find out all of the other sales of that particular person's artwork that have happened in the past and compare yours by size to that. That would be the best research you could do. But appraising art is a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it is still based on the fact that we keep and store these things because the assumption is that they have value.
Mm-hmm. But the value isn't always monetary.
Yes.
The value is absolutely in the story of who we are.
Yes.
But if we're only showing 5% of
the story
at any given time, how valuable is it to us? Like, not if you take the monetary part right out of it, how valuable is it that the museums are holding 95% of their collections in a dark room?
I don't know. And I mean, to some extent, museums have become ginormous tourist attractions.
Mm-hmm.
And the customers or the guests are saying, well, I can't go to the Louvre and not see the Mona Lisa and not see Venus de Milo and not see, you know.
Yeah, they're not going to put those things away to bring out some Austrian artist from, yeah.
No, because that would cut their revenue stream. The Uffizis had the same collection on, you know, Birth of Venus, Primavera, the one with the snakes coming out there. What's that one?
The one with the snakes?
Snakes in the head. Scary. Come on. It's a Medusa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that's why people go. It's like they have a to-do list. A check. Mona Lisa, check. Medusa, check. Primavera,
totally.
Check. Right?
They even create itineraries. If you want to see the three ladies of the Louvre,
yes.
Here's the map. Oh. Here's how you get to the three ladies.
So who are they? Venus?
The Venus de Milo, yeah. The Mona Lisa, and... Winged Victory.
Right.
Yeah, so you have to do the dinner and wing, and then you take a right, and you run down that hall to see the Mona Lisa.
It's a bit of a gong show in there.
Oh, it totally is. Yeah. It's crazy, and it's gotten worse, apparently, just over the last few years. Like, crazy worse, but...
Yes, to the point where if I went back to Paris, I would, like, take a pass.
Yeah, I know.
Which is really sad.
It is very sad.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we went when we did, because, lots of stuff has happened just in the last few years.
I would rather... I would rather see.
Yeah. But I also highly recommend getting one of those Paris pass Firenze pass to get into those museums because 3-hour lineup is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Well, yeah. Anyway.
Anyway,
so
sorry.
Here's
got a bit off track there. But so they are valued, you know, there's an assumption of value. We don't know what we're not seeing, right?
Mm-hmm. And here's something else, just to add to the conversation. The perception right now is that we mainly want to see beautiful things. Mm-hmm. We're not wanting to see the things that are hard to look at. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you can imagine the French Impressionists are the most viewed works that are in collections. So here's an example. Claude Monet, in a sampling, Quartz did this survey of 20 museums in 7 different countries, focusing on 13 major artists. And so for about 2,000 pieces of art, they did this kind of percentage. How many pieces are in collections? How many pieces are being displayed at any given time? So Claude Monet, the museums have 155 Claude Monets on display at this particular time, 63 not on display. He was the highest on display artist in the entire survey. Picasso is next with 139 on display and 108 not on display.
Mm-hmm.
So a little over half of hers were actually viewable. Paul Cézanne next, but 93 on display, 15 not on display. So lots of Paul Cézannes out there. Mary Cassatt, 34 on display, 15 not. Georgia O'Keeffe, 36 on display, 67 not on display. So now we're going into the negative here. Alexander Calder, 27 on display, 88 in storage. Kandinsky, Benton, Koons, Frida Kahlo, like we go on and they're just, it gets worse and worse, right? Mm-hmm. It's like fewer and fewer on display, more and more in the storage box.
Right, right.
So, you know,
how do you make room in the pipeline for the new stuff?
Yeah.
Right? Like in 100 years, are they still going to be seeing the Venus de Milo?
Well, probably because we still.
And the Mona Lisa.
Because we still want to look upon beauty.
Yes.
That is the. I mean, I don't want to say it's a problem, but that is the challenge.
Well, it is a challenge.
Because we're not looking at our real history
and it doesn't really challenge us.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I know.
Yeah.
Today on Artscape, we're talking about the collections of the world of art. No, art collections of the world.
Yes, the collection of the art collection.
Yeah.
Yes.
The art of the collection of the art collection.
Yes.
Art. We'll get a
good
title.
We're collecting a number of titles. We'll let you know what we settle on. And we'll put the rest in storage.
But you'll find those in the podcast list.
Yes.
Hopefully. And that brings us to another aspect, and that is the digitizing of collections.
Okay.
So that is something that a lot of museums are, of course, looking at and pursuing right now. But again, it takes resources to do this. But now they're trying.
You don't want to expose valuable pieces of art to huge amounts of light either. Like, how do you
digitize it? I think they can do it safely now without...
All right. Good to know.
But they're creating virtual tours where you can walk, like, in a virtual reality helmet.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, that is absolutely the future. Yeah.
Not the same as actually going through a museum and looking at the real Voice of Fire.
But to some extent, more sustainable.
Well, at least we get to see the stuff, right? We know what's out there. So it's not the same as the physical reaction that you get when you're standing in front of something that's super powerful. But at least, it's a step.
Yeah.
Other innovative solutions. Some museums are building glass walls around their conservatory rooms so that
you can actually see them.
Yeah. Viewers can watch the conservatories at work.
The British Museum did that. The inside of the British Museum is a giant glass block.
Nice.
And everything is in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's another thing that some museums are doing is actually putting some of their collection into sliding racks that are covered in glass. So you can literally go and pull out racks to look at certain arts, certain works of art.
Yeah, more like a library. Imagine if a library had 90% of its or 95% of its books in storage.
Yeah.
I mean, they do have the stacks, but that's different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's solutions.
Yes.
It's just that it takes resources to figure it out. And there still needs to be a place to put the stuff.
Right.
So storage is still the ultimately the core of the problem with this particular issue.
But we as in our community art collection has been digitized?
Well, to an extent.
Or taken like, photos?
Yes. I have photos of every piece of work that's in our collection because we have a database that has a biography and as much information as we can amass on the artist. And a photo is part of each of those entries. So I do have a photo of each of them, but not necessarily the best quality photo, right? Like I wouldn't be able to make a nice, you know, card print out of it or something.
No.
However, at least it's documented. We know what it looks like. Well, if you go down searching for it, we know what to look for.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's handy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, we've talked about it going online. Like, so that people can look at our collection online.
It would be great. Or do a, I wonder if there's an appetite to collaborate with, say, the virtual reality people who know and understand that technology in this community.
Mm.
It certainly would expose them to, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah, and there's another reason why we might want to get it online is because other galleries and museums can see what we have because the loaning of work for exhibition purposes is a thing.
Oh, of course, yeah. And people might not understand that.
Yeah.
They'll go around the world and say, you got one of those? You got one? Can we have it? And we're going to go put this show together and it'll tour. Yeah.
Yeah. Like at some point, somebody might contact us and say, you've got that Edith Hembroff-Schleicher portrait of Emily Carr.
Mm-hmm.
And so this piece is in the exhibition. You'll be able to see it. I mean, it has been in our display case for, you know, a while, so you get to see it anyway. But Annie Martin, who's a local artist who's fairly new to our community, has responded to the Edith portrait of Emily Carr. And kind of brought that story to light. And it's interesting because Edith Hembroff-Schleicher was a friend and student of Emily Carr's.
Wow.
Did this portrait.
Yes.
Had an exhibition in the 70s in Victoria. Josephine Parrott bought one of the portraits, brought it back to her home in Salmon Arm. And then upon her passing, she actually personally donated it to the Arts Council collection and some other works upon her passing. But it's like probably an extremely valuable piece.
I'm sure it is.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's an interesting story collection. I just can't remember where
has our collection been appraised. No, that would be too expensive.
No. That would be a whole like 1 year consultant's job to just do that. It would be a crazy amount of work to appraise our collection. I couldn't even put a guess.
Of course not.
Yeah. However, I'm sure that particular piece is valuable. Like I said before, we have Chris Kranz. That would be of interest to other museums that might want to put together a Chris collection, exhibition. And so, yeah, I mean, there's just opportunities out there. If people don't know what we have, how can we take advantage of
that? Yeah, how can we participate in the greater conversation?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that might be one of the sustainable actions that museums and galleries can do is start sharing more.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of creating work, getting artists to create work for the collections, we actually build exhibitions borrowing work.
Right.
And we can still make it apply to today's issues and stuff. We don't have to go way back and getting things from 50, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We can just, you know, I know that Edward Bertinsky works were in a Kamloops Art Gallery exhibition recently, and they don't own any Edward Bertinsky. Those were borrowed. So it was part like two or three pieces.
Yeah, so you
part of a larger
and
thematic
and,
yeah it's a thing. We should just share more is the thing.
It's always the answer.
Yeah.
Share more.
Yeah it's a good philosophy. All right, so
except when it comes to roller skates, that's a little tricky to share.
That is tricky. Yeah, okay. There's a story
thought.
There.
Yeah. No, I just had visions of, hey, you want one of my roller skates? Well, that's useful. Or gloves. Would you like a glove?
That's, not the same. Anyway, some of the names that people might recognize that of works that we have in the collection that are being responded to by contemporary artists are Gudrun Weisinger.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Gudrun?
Yes, of course.
Of course. And such a huge influence on the fiber community that, it was a easy Goody Hupfauer right away. Mm-hmm. I want to respond to Gudrun's work. And they were very good friends.
Aww,
and so it's a lovely response to her. Marcel Asquin.
Yes.
Did you ever meet Marcel Asquin?
No, I do know the name.
Oh, when I first started at the gallery, he was around and just a lovely fellow.
Aww.
And so there's a work that was donated to the collection by his daughter. Laura Sprovieri has responded to it. It's quite charming.
Oh, I cannot wait.
I know. It's actually really exciting. Frances Hatfield.
Yes,
did you ever meet Frances?
I knew of her. I knew her to see her, but I did not meet her.
She was also this amazing, lovely person who was so generous with her knowledge and so wonderful. Mainly in the community of Enderby Armstrong, doing lots of work there, lots of community work as well as teaching and just bringing people under her wing. Yeah,
beautiful legacy.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. And innovative. Like when she had eye surgery, her whole painting style changed. I think she had something happen to her right wrist, so she started painting with her left hand, had an entire exhibition in Vernon of left hand painting.
Wow.
I know, like just crazy.
Who knew?
Innovative.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Don Scott is in dialogue with one of Frances's monoprints, which is not a usual, like it's not a kind of a recognizable Frances paintings. She did a whole series of monoprints when she was going back and forth to Mexico and spending winters there. So it's kind of different, right? Like it's a challenge for an artist to say.
Yeah, and we forget, like artists have done all sorts of studies and styles and, you know, early Picassos are nothing like late Picassos.
Yeah.
And Jackson Pollock did know how to
he was a realist.
Draw things, right?
Yeah.
Like
an incredible landscape painter.
Right? So we forget that.
Mm-hmm. We have a fiber piece by Marie Manson that Myrna Button is responding to. It's lovely. Mary Lethem, of course.
I have a little Mary Lethem.
Do you?
I do.
Aww. That's exciting.
In my back part of my house.
Yep.
Little wee tiny. I see it every day.
Yep. Same. I have two. A little tiny Mary Lethem and then a big long landscape. So exciting.
Right. And they bring me joy. So I know they have value, but
yeah,
I know there's a price, but it's mostly a value for me. Yeah.
Yeah. We have quite a few Mary Lethems in the collection because we were working on a solo exhibition for her.
Well, I have a little piece if you need one.
Before.
Oh, you were. Okay.
In 2013.
Oh.
She passed away only about 8 months before her show.
Oh,
I know. It was one of those things, right? Like I knew that she was getting close to the end of her life and it was kind of this sense of urgency. It's like, okay, we got to do this. So it was kind of the earliest we could schedule it based on other contracts we had in place. I so wanted to have all of her tiny watercolors because she just had stacks of watercolors that were bigger watercolors that she didn't finish, but there'd be a little tiny part of it that was very finished. So we went through them all, cropping them and making these tiny pieces. And then she was signing them and, you know, like,
what I got.
That's probably, got one of those.
Yeah.
So we got, all these little things framed up and everything. And then, and she passed on. But we had this incredible show of hers and we did sell the works and all the proceeds to that went towards went into the endowment fund to support her prize at the fall fair. So it's the Mary Lethem Art Prize, $100, best work of art.
And
all
every
classes.
Year it gets paid out by, right? So that legacy piece does.
There is.
Have importance and value.
Yeah. So Maureen Howard and Tina Lethem, Tina is Mary's daughter-in-law, and Maureen Howard is the daughter of one of Mary's very close friends, formed a collaborative to respond to Mary's
work.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, very personal.
So pottery, painted pottery. It's really cool. Anyway, so we're excited to have that little piece in the collection. Actually, it's a new piece that people haven't seen because it was one of the Dolores Murray collection
pieces.
There
we go.
Mm-hmm. Vivian Lindo, some people might remember that name. We had a couple of pieces in the collection that were shown up at the college for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Miller is responding to her work. And she was a printmaker. Now, Vivian is one of those groundbreaking artists that we hardly know anything about just because she wasn't necessarily born and raised in Salmon Arm. She moved here after her divorce from her husband, Luke, and her husband founded the Medicine Hat like clay community. Whoa. Like Plainsman Clays was founded by Lindo.
Yeah.
And Luke was quite a well-known artist too.
Yes.
Vivian and Luke. And actually there's a whole legacy of kids and grandkids that are all in the arts field and amazingly successful. But Vivian moved back here to, well, I think she grew up in somewhere in the area, but she moved to Salmon Arm, bought this little acreage at the bottom of Mount Ida, built her own house of her own design with her own two hands.
Wow.
Literally. And even in her daughter's little biography, it says something like, she built her own house with a circular saw, a plane, a questionable hammer, and possibly a screwdriver.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she was just one of those women that could just do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Responsible for a lot of very contemporary art ideas coming to Alberta at a time when, it was still very landscape and traditional.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty groundbreaking gal. And so Susan Miller has responded to some of that story as well, right?
Wow. And so all of this information is available online yet or no? Part of the catalog?
Well, the catalog is only coming... we'll be up there on Friday night. Yeah. And actually, you know what? That's a good point. We probably should put the catalog online during the course of the exhibition so that people can spend the time reading about these.
Yes, because you'd want to have that story maybe.
Yeah. I think having the story
ahead
of time...
If you're a planner, you kind of want
to... Yeah. Write. Some people like to just be visual.
I'm more like that. I like to come in and immerse myself. But some people would prefer to know the story.
I want to know the story. Yeah. I'm a story girl.
But that's why we're good co-hosts.
Yeah. We're different.
Yes.
Yeah. So it'll be... Yeah. It'll probably be available, but it's in the catalog. There's a lot of reading to do. I just feel like people need to give themselves the time. Mm-hmm. This is not going to be a 5-minute exhibition where you just run in, see it in 5 minutes and go out again.
No.
And then the artist talk that we're having is on February 21st, which is almost at the end of the show. So it's kind of too bad that we won't get that at the beginning. It just kind of works out. Third Thursday situation is, kind of how it goes. But I feel...
And so how many works? 12?
There's actually 13 works, being responded to.
Okay, bye.
12 artists and then one arts group, one whole Bay Painters, 20 artists all responded to Margaret Lund. And the way that they responded is just by identifying light. They focused on the light. So that was kind of an interesting way of all artists of different media being able to come together in a common idea, right?
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's hard.
And now... As the art world turns, a dramatic moment in the arts.
I just love how we both still love that intro.
Yeah, we do still love that.
soap opera.
Yeah, it worked out. That was kind of like a random, hey, I got this cool thing at the joke shop for my kids. Like, we could use that on the show, right? Anyway.
Now it's iconic.
It is. Almost iconic.
People
hear it. Iconic. We've been doing this 5 years.
Yeah.
We should be iconic.
I think so.
Still working. Work in progress.
Yeah.
So for the dramatic moment, I mean, sometimes they're funny and sometimes they're silly. Sometimes they're sad. This one is a bit dark.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that there's an underside of collecting.
The underbelly.
Yeah, that we don't really... I mean, some people talk about it quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, art is a powerful cultural influencer. And... there are vast quantities of money made by dealers and auction houses, and even galleries to some extent, the bigger ones. But the truth is many collections don't actually belong to the people who own them.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens through war and cultural appropriation.
Colonization.
And so how do we have that conversation in a way that's respectful? I mean, you know, there's been movies about art looted by the Nazis and, you know, sort of popular culture.
Did you see The Monuments Men?
No, I did not.
That's actually a really cool movie. Yes. I think it got panned by the critics, but it's super cool because...
And that's precisely what it's about, right?
Yeah.
It's repatriating the art.
Yeah, trying to rescue it before it's destroyed.
Before it was destroyed.
Yeah.
Or, you know, war destroying sacred spaces and places and pieces. And and it happens a lot, a great deal, I would say, in Aboriginal communities.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, it goes back to Egyptian times. And, you know, the Louvre has a wing of Egyptian art, very little of which actually belongs to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. It was basically looted.
Yes.
It was just seen as legal at the time.
Yes.
I guess, and appropriate. Oh, yeah. We're going to preserve
this for you. And the imperialists would go in and say, it's our country now. Thanks for the marble sculpture.
Yeah. And right? Well, you guys won't know what to do with this. We'll put it in our museum.
So that is a rather dark side. And I think more and more work is being done, especially on the Aboriginal reconciliation piece. Mm-hmm. So this idea of appropriating a what you see as a collection are actually sacred cultural
objects
that belong to a culture that aren't to be used as a form of, you know, cultural entertainment, I guess, right?
Yeah, just for our viewing pleasure.
Yeah, and we're making assumptions. Well, this piece is this, and this piece is that. When really we're not in a position to be really informed about the value or the story or the significance. There's an example from 2010 when an Australian museum returned some Aboriginal remains to their rightful place. And they weren't actually that old. So when you think about, I mean, it's kind of disturbing that we have this,
that they were taken,
this skull from antiquity. No, that was somebody's grandparent, right?
Exactly.
You know, so it's terribly inappropriate.
Like, we crossed the line between artifact and just remains.
And quite cruel as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, what? Why do we call it an artifact?
Yes.
I mean, this is somebody's...
And who decides whether or not it has... If it's an artifact.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, there must
be... changing
landscape, there must be cases of things being on display or like, really? That's like a Pepsi can. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's something that's been dealt with a lot of contemporary artists, right? They're looking at what is an artifact and what is appropriation and all this stuff.
Yeah, right? An artifact by definition is an object.
Yeah.
Right? So there are pop culture artifacts and maybe the Pepsi can is in fact a pop culture artifacts. But if it's being sort of assimilated by another culture to say, oh, aren't we clever? Look what this collection we put together, like that you found that didn't belong to you in the first place.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as old as you think, and you have no idea what the true cultural significance of it is, right? So there's a lot of humility, I would imagine. There's a lot of sort of soul-searching, heart-wrenching decisions to come to, you know.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we can't relate to as a European, as a settler culture, where our things of cultural significance are things that we hang on the wall, right? That's what we do. But that's not necessarily what other cultures do.
No.
And so when we take those culturally significant objects and hang them on our wall, that is the most inappropriate thing that you should be doing.
Well, I would agree.
But we haven't, we think we're honoring it somehow because that's our cultural past. So that's, you know, it's something that it's all about education and understanding and learning. So we have to learn to do things differently.
Yes.
And we have to be able to start again by giving back those things and saying, here, this doesn't belong to us. This belongs to you.
So our pieces are being
repatriated.
Repatriated to their rightful place. So I would suspect that that's a trend we'll see.
Yeah.
Increase,
absolutely. Right? I think it's an important part of reconciliation. And in Canada, I mean,
because what happens is you then assume the value of the piece, and then if you auction that piece, right? So you're taking the major financial benefit from a piece that didn't actually belong to you in the first place.
Yeah.
And now you're saying, "Well, it's mine because I paid for it." So I would argue that nobody really owns art
at all.
It stays with the artist. You pay for the right to show it or to store it, for heaven's sakes, which seems ridiculous, but right.
But the, I mean, that's an other whole.
Yes,
like the
But it is the dark side.
Every time
collecting.
Something sells, and sells for more and more and more money, the artist never sees a penny of
No,
that.
Of course not. That's why Banksy built in the,
the paper shredder.
The paper shredder, which unfortunately makes it worth more now than it was.
Isn't that crazy?
I'm sure he wouldn't. I'm sure he knows that. Yeah,
it's just
this idea of trying to value a moment in time or a thought or an impression or and we do need to do hard we have to do the difficult work. We have to expose ourselves to art that tells difficult stories, that challenges assumptions, that you sort of wake us up to some realities that, you know, life is good when you're looking at a Cezanne or a Monet or a Manet or, you know. But those aren't the most difficult. I mean, Picasso did some pretty dark stuff.
Yeah.
Right? But he's really celebrated for for not that period in his working life.
Yeah, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Well, except certain ones like Guernica is pretty much.
And I mean, to me, that's his legacy.
Yeah.
And that was the very difficult piece.
And it's a hard piece to look at, right?
Yes, it is a hard
piece to know about.
But it was a significant turning point in the in the Civil War in Spain,
yeah,
right? And it still reminds them of that those difficult moments in their own history.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible things were done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what artwork does.
Yes, and people have done terrible things for art.
Yeah. But I do want to say that there's ways that we can still be respectful and approach reconciliation in an artistic way that is all about true collaboration.
Yes.
Like real open collaboration, mm-hmm. not just, hey, do you want to have some input in this idea I have?
Yes.
No. Utilizing the institutions and the places.
Yeah,
the venues,
we have
the
space.
Have.
Yeah. There is a story. Help us tell it in a way that is appropriate and respectful and meaningful, right. and that will share values that otherwise wouldn't be shared.
Yeah. And there's lots of elements to that that I think get skipped over. Mm-hmm. And I think some institutions will have these exhibitions saying, but we are in collaboration with the community. But then maybe the community isn't present to actually share the work, right? Like that's the thing is the institutions have to hire docents actually from the community in order to adequately share the story that is true to this, to the culture.
Yes.
And I think we're missing that little piece. We're just missing a lot of the collaboration mm-hmm. pieces. We might think we're collaborating, but I think there's a lot of work to be done. Yet.
Yeah. And in some ways it's, you know, the British Museum did this big 6-month show about Australian Aboriginal peoples and cultural artifacts. And it's kind of like, well, how dare you? Like, is that really your story to tell?
Mm.
It doesn't sound like they had much collaboration. And then they took it to Australia, showed it in Canberra, which is the capital of Australia. Again, not necessarily their story to tell, right?
Like
you can't co-opt other people's stories.
No.
It's very rude.
And we're coming to a time where that's finally being understood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like 20 years ago, people were like, why not? I should be able to tell any kind of story I want if I think it's of interest to, you know, the people I'm serving.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're...
done some terrible things in the name of entertainment and mm-hmm. education, haven't we?
But finally mm-hmm. we're getting somewhere.
Yes, I think so.
All right, fiery discussion. See, I told you collections were not going to be a boring topic.
Not boring.
Not at all.
Nope.
Before we finish and talk about some of the details of the upcoming exhibition in dialogue with the collection,
mm-hmm.
Let's thank our incredible sponsor.
Yeah, so collect yourself some reusable bags and head on down and get some vitamin C because apparently the oranges are back.
What?
Yes.
Another round of oranges?
Yes.
We're so lucky.
Yeah.
So
I
think I saw the sign said Grandpa's Neighbor.
Yes.
So it's not Grandpa's oranges, but Grandpa's Neighbor still had oranges.
Come on.
So you had to go next door to get the oranges.
Yes.
It happens all the time, I'm sure. But thank you so much to DeMille's Farm Market
absolutely.
For being our sponsor. Yeah. And it's such a great place to visit.
For sure. So. And they do curate and celebrate the bounty of our harvest, right?
Yeah.
And
the local.
And they keep us healthy and going in the winter and in the summer. So
exactly.
Can't do this stuff without people like DeMille's.
That's right.
No.
Thank you, Brad.
Yeah.
All right. So upcoming In Dialogue with the Collection opens Friday, January 18th, continues until Saturday, February 23rd. The gallery hours are Tuesday to Saturday, 11 till 4. Admission is by donation.
Mm-hmm.
The coffee break and artist talk, which is an important time to understand some of the processes and a great time to ask questions of the artist, is on Thursday, February 21st from 2 till 4. And you also get fresh baked cookies and organic locally roasted coffee.
Mm.
I know. So it's actually
delish.
A pretty darn good deal.
Yes.
We'll have an artist trading card day on the 12th, February 12th. So that's kind of a fun time. It's only an hour, 3 o'clock. You come in, trade your ATCs.
Mm-hmm.
You can make some more if you want. What else? Basically, we're just having all the sort of... Oh, I know the other thing.
Oh, there's another thing. There's lots of things.
I'm fairly certain that Kate is going to host another sound bath during this show.
Yeah.
And I think it's on Valentine's Day.
Marvelous.
Yeah. At like 5 or something. So it's early.
Perfect.
Like right after closing, 4:30 or 5. So watch for that.
Mm-hmm.
She tends to put all of our upcoming events on Facebook. So it's a good idea to watch Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But we also list our events by date on the participate page. On salmonarmartcenter.ca. Yes. So it's another great way to find out all arts events coming up in the area. And now, you know, now that it's January, I mean,
Oh, days are getting longer. Everybody's getting a little stir crazy. Time to get out and try something new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's still things to do. There's still lots of cultural activities in our community.
Yes.
So you want to check it out. And there's movies, Film Society. Oh, did you see The Grizzlies?
No.
Did you go to the movie? It was packed.
Oh, good.
It was such a good movie.
That's great.
Yeah. And now Green Book's playing for 7 days, or maybe maybe not anymore. I don't know. But Film Society movies, and of course, you know, just always upcoming things. The Trail Alliance party is coming up in February, and there's just workshops and cool art things to do. Just keep checking in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stay connected.
All right. We're taking a week off. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And have a great week, everyone. Yeah.
See you around.